I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 6, 2015. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Coghill, and myself, Senator Giesel. Recording secretary today helping us out is Ann. Jonathan is on the audio, and Ike is the committee aide. So thanks for your help, everybody. So today we're going to take up the confirmation from Mr. Rick Halford to the Board of Directors of the Alaska Gas and Electric Development Corporation. We'll then take up House Bill 70, and if there's time, Senate Bill 48. So we'll start out with the confirmation hearing for Mr. Halford. Mr. Halford, welcome. I'll invite you to the table. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm looking at Kramer's Field Migratory Waterfowl.
That's the next item on the agenda. Yes, you could read that if you wanted while you're waiting. So you are an appointee for the AGDC board. So what I do for board appointments is just review briefly the statute that defines the role. So for committee members, Section AS 3125020 says the board of the corporation shall be governed by a board of directors consisting of five public members and two individuals designated by the governor. Parenthetically, those two individuals are the commissioner of commerce and the commissioner of labor. But going back to the public members, for which Mr. Halford is an appointee, the public members of the board shall be appointed by the governor and are subject to confirmation by the legislature. When appointing a public member to the board, the governor shall consider an individual's expertise and experience in natural gas pipeline construction, operation and marketing, finance, large project management, and other expertise and experience that is relevant to the purpose, powers, and duties of the corporation. Public members serve staggered five-year terms. Mr. Halford is appointed for a term that began 2/19 of 15, so that's February of this year, and will expire in September of 2016. So, Mr. Halford, if you would just introduce yourself for the committee. I do expect Senator Welikowski and Senator Michiki to join us at some point. Senator Michiki is in finance. But if you could just introduce yourself, your interest in this position, and experience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I graduated from Alaska Methodist University in 68 and had no idea that I would end up in the political arena at that time, but I spent 24 years of my adult life in this building, and I was a very slow learner. I guess it took me that long to graduate. But I served in the House 4 years on the Resources Committee. In the Senate, I chaired the Resources Committee, the Judiciary Committee, the Finance Committee, the Rules Committee over different years, and spent, I think, six terms as a majority leader and a couple terms as Senate President. And as you know, and I'm sure you enjoy, these positions are probably the best place to learn things that you can think of. Because if you refuse to decide, you can basically get the best education you could possibly get from the advocates of one point of view or the other. The first issue I dealt with in the House Resources Committee in 1979, I guess it was the interim tariff on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Of course, the first step, why do we have to deal with it? Why is the state regulating it? Why is it interim? Why isn't it permanent? I mean, all the questions you can ask. But it was a great part of what kept me here for 24 years, and that is that you can really learn a lot about a lot of different things. I think the first time I was on a gas line direct issue rather than resources committees, was in the mid-90s on a governor's task force on gas line financing. We've been trying to do this for a very, very long time. And I think there are better options now than there have ever been before. But I do think they require everybody being on the same side. And that's the tough part of what's going on. I am very interested in seeing a gas line. I think the chances of getting one are still low because of what's out there and what all the options are. But I think they're much, much better if the legislative branch, the executive branch, are going the same direction. And that is something that I hope we can figure out how to do. I don't have any magic wand to that. I believe in the governor. I believe in the legislative branch. And I believe that we may have a window where it has become in the self-interest of at least one of the majors to do something that they haven't been willing to do before.
Very good. Questions from committee members? Do I see your hand, Senator Stoltz? No. Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll start out. So, jumping right into it, you've been an advocate in the past for the Gasoline Port Authority.
Yes.
So, I've heard skepticism from other Port Authority folks about this pipeline. Sounds like you may have some skepticism about AKLNG also. Is that true, or am I misinterpreting?
Well, no. I think we're trying to push a very, very difficult, huge project. So skepticism is not really the way I would look at it, but I think obviously we've been either 37 or 40 years or whatever number you want to pick up as trying to do this. So it's obviously eluded legislators and executives for all that time. And it's my view that generally, as much as we try from the political process to make things move, it's kind of like pushing one arm into the rope. Unless something pulls on the other end, we don't get anywhere. And that's economic determinations. Maybe because of Point Thompson, maybe because of the other options that are out there and the interest that we've seen from Exxon, maybe this is a chance. And I think we should do everything we can to try and push that chance as much as we can.
Very good. Thank you. I want to recognize that Senator McChicky has joined us. Welcome. I also neglected to note that former Senate President Drew Pierce is in the audience. So welcome. Welcome, Drew. So, Senator Halford, did you request this appointment to the AGDC board, or how did it come about?
I was asked if I would serve, and I said, yeah, sure. But I didn't really think about it that much. I said I would. I was interested, and I had some history, but it was 10 years before in terms of the Port Authority. I worked for the Port Authority for probably a little over a year. But it was not something that I heard much about, and then the appointment, I was on the Salary Commission, and that's a commission that has a prohibition on being on anything else. So I resigned from that sometime in January, and nothing happened for quite a while. I think it was a month later they finally made the appointment.
All right. Further questions, committee members? Senator Coghill.
Rick, thank you for taking the appointment. I appreciate that. And I know you're one of the hardest workers, and you've done a good job. But you can appreciate our skepticism. It looks like, to us, the governor has assembled kind of the Port Authority team while we're trying to work through on a couple of projects. One is the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, and one is the AKLNG. The AKLNG, we're trying to get to that front-end engineering design process. So as you've just now begun to step out of one realm and into the other, kind of give us your view as you see the kind of the structure of the AKLNG project and how that will work with the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, because in some ways you have to be like we do. We have to keep both of them right in our front view. And it seems to me that only one can go forward, but you're unplugging from your experience with the Port Authority. And the skepticism guys like me might have are we going to try to fit the Port Authority into it, or are we going to work these projects to their best economic end?
Of course, the short answer is I haven't had anything to do with the Port Authority for probably a decade, so I'm not exactly sure what they're doing. But I think they have a major victory to start with, and that is that instead of looking toward a long line pipeline through Canada, we're looking at LNG. And I think the Port Authority, the governor, and everybody should claim victory, because that is an important thing. I mean, we're now going to a market that can move by seaborne transportation to a lot of potential destinations. It's much more flexible. That's one of the arguments we had back when that whole consideration was there. There's other pieces of that, but I really don't know what the Port Authority would want today. I haven't all of it particularly.
Hello?
No, I appreciate that. It's just that I wanted to express to him some of the things that we see being assembled together. I think maybe I should just make the comment that, you know, we debated long and hard over trying to get the AKLNG project in line, and we felt that what we did with the Alaska Standalone Pipeline got us to that point. And I guess there's a concern on our part that if we start competing with ourselves on it, that we could mess it up, because I think you're right. I think the economics of it, no matter how we look at it, are probably pretty thin.
The economics are much bigger than we are. And all the political pressure that we can create is not going to make or break what the multi-billion dollar economic decisions are. If we can possibly go forward with the AKLNG line, then we should minimize the amount of money we spend on the backup and still try to be in the knowledge realm, in the information realm, have something so that we're not totally unarmed. But obviously the project that's got the sponsors with the money to build it is the first issue.
So let me follow up on that. AGDC, the board, met, I don't know, maybe it was about two and a half weeks ago. And at that meeting, you all voted unanimously to pass a resolution to conduct some further studies, cost analyses, on enlarging the smaller pipeline, the ASAP pipeline, that is 100% state-owned.
Right.
So $180 million left in the piggy bank, so to speak, and the board chose to begin spending some of that money. What did you consider as you thought about your vote on that resolution? What prompted you to vote yes to spend additional money on more studies?
Well, if you look at the transcript, you'll see that I made it very clear that what I was voting on was a pipe strength. They'd already decided it was 36-inch pipe, and they were talking about schedule 600 to schedule 900. And I thought that was a very simple, cheap option in terms of having more information. The big questions were pump stations and the gas conditioning plant. And there's a huge amount of money spent on a gas conditioning plant at the 500 level. And when you go up to 2.6 or 3.0, if it goes up in proportion, and there were some questions, by the way, whether the process would have to change. And there's other questions about what the composition of gas is that we don't necessarily have information on. So it just, the questions got bigger and bigger. So my interest, and I hadn't seen that resolution until the meeting, my interest was to ask the simplest question, the cheapest possible. What can you do with the pipe size? Because that gives you the most options to change in the future. But the options you would have to change to make it work are huge in terms of the amount of money to spend. And I believe in what you're trying to do with the spending stream. And spending money to study things that we won't do is an outcome that I don't particularly like. And we can all look back at the articles. And, you know, the legislative process, when I have a good big idea and you have a good big idea and you have a good big idea, we all get together and we fund studies of lots of big ideas. And we spent hundreds of millions of dollars doing it, and we can't afford it. So your concern is very well taken. I think keeping the Alaska project as a reserve at reasonable, and I mean minimal cost, is worthwhile. So that's the way I looked at that vote. There was a subsequent motion that wasn't a resolution that kind of tried to add back in all those same things. And we didn't have, and we don't have yet, cost analysis for what it costs to ask some of those questions. But I'm not crazy about spending hundreds of millions of dollars on a backup in a very short time frame that may not generate anything more viable than we have. I mean, yes, the current size was too small. But the question I was interested in is the pipe strength, schedule 600, schedule 900.
So you're right, adding more compression stations, et cetera, seems like a pretty easy calculation to make. Did you or others on the board ask the question of what would be done with that additional gas, where it would go? Did you discuss the cost of an export facility, an LNG export component?
I think there was recognition of all those things, but there was not a lot of discussion. And we were just asking for it. There was no determination to do anything. It was asking a question for information. But the problem is some of those questions, based on the complexity, become hugely expensive.
I did read the transcript. Thank you. And that therein is lies my concern. You know, you were newly appointed board members, and you were deciding to spend more money. And so therein lies my concern. Do you recall who made the motion on that resolution?
I don't. I'm sure it's in the transcript. I've got a piece of the transcript that was the one of the questions, but I don't have the whole transcript with me.
All right. That's fine. Thank you. Any other questions, committee members? Oh, and by the way, Senator Wielkowski has joined us. Thank you. Welcome, Senator Wielkowski. Further questions from committee members?
No question.
Senator Machicki.
And hello, Senator Halford. Question for you. So one project is an integrated system, right? It's essentially cradle to grave, wellhead to foreign point of delivery. Okay, AKLNG, which was sort of the beauty of it, and the other project obviously isn't. I mean, you assume that those pieces would be coming, but in the discussion you talk about, somehow with Craig Richards, my questions were pointed. I hope you don't feel like my questions are pointed, because they're not at all. I guess what I'm coming down to here is, we were pretty excited about a project that exposed the state, the people of Alaska, only 25% of the investment total. And depending on what the ultimate cost of the project, the AKLNG project, might be, I'm fairly comfortable with that, because I know how tight those other companies are on risk. They don't like risk. They're well equipped to deal with risk. And perhaps we're not as experienced in that level of risk. So I'm wondering why we would consider a project that may not have those partners. I worry about a project that where the state of Alaska, the 750,000 souls, of which a very small proportion of them have the ability to even be responsible for part of that risk. Why would we do that? I'm just kind of interested in your philosophy on why we would take that path at this time, knowing we have sort of a plan on the shelf for upsizing. Everyone realizes that the smaller, the 500 MCF limit is not a real project. Why would we take that level of risk at this time, and why would another Alaskan assume that it's an appropriate level for Alaska?
I'm not convinced at this time that we should. I think that's a big jump. I always, in this process, I always wanted to see the investment of the private sector and the risk of the private sector always in front of the investment of the state and the risk of the state, because they're better at it than we are. We decide things politically, they decide things based on the downstream economics. And yes, they want their share, and they're tough at it. But we tend to change our mind way too often, and we're not as good at business as they are. If we were, we'd be, I can't think of a word, very different.
So follow up,
Senator Machicki?
Madam Chair, and so on that note, those companies have ways of making up mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. When you look at our level, and when you look at our the type of investments we make, even in the permanent fund, or the typical municipality, those are investments that are very risk-averse,
mm-hmm.
simply because we don't have a way of making up mistakes, right? Especially now. I mean, we're mm-hmm. challenged on revenue, limited amount of savings. We can't tap into a project, another project of ours or another product line. We sort of have a one shot at this. I mean, I just want to hear a little bit more that you, how you feel about that. Alaska as a sovereign has a limited potential on correcting a major risk mistake. I just want to hear your feelings on that if you...
Well, that's absolutely true. Anytime we deal with multinational corporations with fantastic careers, huge rewards, options and everything else, our side of the table has got relatively short-term players. And the people we hire are relatively short-term players. And a lot of the consultants we hire are people that are going to get their next job from the other side of the table. The only advantage we have is we have the ability of a sovereign to change some of the rules after the fact if we do too poorly. But just in general, we haven't done very well on some of the ownership decisions, and then we've been criticized for changing some of the tax decisions after the fact. But it's an ongoing relationship. The industry makes money. The state has changed astronomically because of the resources. I was here when the Prudhoe Bay discovery occurred, and it's a different place. And we don't always like to share everything, but the fact is it's a lot safer and it's a lot better place. It's just not quite as friendly as it used to be.
One more.
Yes, follow-up, Senator Chicky.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's the correct term, right? Once you're a senator, you're always your highest. Anyway.
You can't shake the curse.
Senator Halford, you talked about some level of spending on investigating expanding the ASAP project. Just can you give me an idea what you, just in your mind at this time, what is a top level of spending of that remaining $180 million? Someone said we don't have to worry. Someone in this committee said we don't have to worry. The $180 million is not enough to build a pipeline. I'm convinced it's enough to cancel a pipeline. So, what is your mind, what is a top dollar amount that you would find sort of acceptable of that remaining $180 million to study the upsizing of the ASAP line?
I would hope that we would never spend 20% of it. Hopefully not 10% of it. I mean, the other side of looking at $180 million is look what you could do in the stuff that you're taking all the heat for reducing with that kind of money. I mean, that's big money. And I don't think we should be spending that in the very short window that we have to find out what the other players are going to do with the primary project.
Senator Costello.
Thank you, Senator Halford. Just a couple questions. First is, do you think the market can be predicted? Can you predict the market?
Well, I certainly can't. And I'm not sure that the state can, and I'm not sure that the industry can. I think they can predict parameters, but I had the good fortune a long, long time ago of flying around a former Secretary General of OPEC in a different world when we were down to $8 or $10 oil, and he was working as a consultant after he retires from Ecuador. But he said at the time, and I've never forgotten this statement, he said, and it was, again, different numbers. We were at $8 or $10 oil, and we were just dying for $30 oil. And he said, don't ever forget that the world is awash in $30 oil. Now, inflation and everything has changed, and now we've seen that if you get to $100 oil, you make a huge number of other things economic. And once they're in the supply stream, then the world changes. So I don't think we can necessarily predict it. I think we can get short-term looks, and we can depend on them to predict it probably better than we're going to be able to predict it.
Follow up, Senator Costello?
I agree with you, but you had said earlier you think AKLNG chances are low, and so to me that's, I mean, it seems like everyone who comes before the committee is saying what you said, which is we've been trying so long, we're never going to make it, chances are low, we have to not put all our eggs in one basket, so we're going to go over and we're going to start resurrecting ASAP, just because we want to know some more information. But what I don't understand is we're going to know if we get to FEED with AKLNG fairly soon, so why would we confuse the market? To me, the priority should be clarity for the market, not focusing on necessarily are we all getting along. We were all getting along, and we had a clear plan in the bill that was passed with hundreds and hundreds of hours that went into it, and a clear backup plan. And now, in my estimation, we're confusing the market by sort of giving lip service to AKLNG, saying that yeah, it has a chance, but we need to make sure that we know that this is probably not going to be where we find our success. And to me, it seems like it's become a popularity project rather than what it should be, which is driven by statute, driven by law, driven by market choices. It's a stage-gated project. It has stage gates, so we will know at each stage. So we're like right at the 26th mile in the marathon, and everyone's saying, hey, you know, I decided I don't want to finish this marathon because we think some other, you know, project over here has more, I don't know, attraction for people. I mean, I think politics should stay out of it. I think the market will speak. The market will speak clearly and definitively. Doesn't bother me that there are these other projects competing. We're almost at FEED, and then we'll know. And I was hoping you can explain sort of why the rush on ASAP. Why even do anything? Why not follow the law that was passed?
Well, of course, I'm trying to sort out the question and the discussion. But I think our best chance is the big producer project. That doesn't mean we shouldn't have, at least if it's low cost, a reasonable backup and information available. But I'm not saying that the AKLNG project is not the best project. I think it has the most chance of success, clearly. So if we're doing anything else, it's only because that has somehow stopped. Other than that, it's information, it's trying to have an alternative, but it's not to supplant that project in a very short time frame. I mean, it's not a long time to wait to see what they come up with.
Follow-up, Senator Castell? So let me go back to the resolution then that you guys passed. You mentioned, we've talked about the $180 million that AGDC has in their piggy bank, I call it. Did you set a spending cap for these new studies for enlarging the thickness of the pipe, more compression? Did you instruct the staff that you have this spending cap that you can use on that $180 million, or did you leave it ill-defined?
It is left ill-defined, and if I had it to do again, I probably would have gone back and said, but I thought the pipe question was going to be the only question. That's what I was interested in. I thought it could be pretty easily done without a lot of cost. I think the question of going back and re-engineering the gas conditioning plant to make it 4 or 5 times bigger when it cost a fortune to engineer it as it is, was one that I was not that interested in. And I think it's a legitimate question about how much you're going to spend to do that.
I'm glad you're asking the question. The unfortunate thing is that you're asking it in retrospect, of course, because there's also compression that will go into it. What type of gas will it be? Burnetip-ready gas? Will it be LNG-grade gas? All of those kinds of questions, of course, will go into this cost analysis, and I don't know what it will cost either. You know, the governor has talked about wanting majority ownership in whatever pipeline goes forward. He's even called out 51%. So as a board member, have you had discussions or have you read any of the transcripts that talk about whether we would be the owner-builder, whether there'd be an owner-builder-operator? If so, who would it be? what is your level of knowledge on those issues?
I really don't, I mean, I haven't been in that level of discussion. You know, it's very nice to think about how big a percentage you want to own, but when you look at something that's $60-70 billion and you look at the state assets and you look at concentrating something that is now very broadly based and bringing a huge amount of money into the state, the permanent fund, and concentrating it into all your eggs in one basket, I worry about that. So that's the balance I would take if I were in that discussion. I don't know the answer, but I know that it would not be taken lightly by either the public or by me. I think the numbers are astronomical. The numbers just to get estimates are astronomical. I mean, we do this periodically on major projects, and we end up with nothing but studies.
Very true. Further questions from committee members?
I have one.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
I was working on this the other day, and I talked earlier about sort of there's an economy to risk, right? Especially in a state with limited potential for revenue. And it doesn't matter how rosy it gets, we've got a limited potential considering we're all hydrocarbon production, mm-hmm. most of it. What I was kind of investigating, scratching my head about is this seems more of an exercise in increasing the proportion of ownership versus increasing versus having a backup plan. And I'll tell you why I say that. What I was looking into is I could not find a single situation in sort of modern industrial terms where lowering the economy of scale has become more economic in a project. And what began with Henry Ford is essentially turned into, you know, modern economies, before you make a large project decision, has come to a science where very little is left to risk. Why did you vote yes? And did you, in your mind, did you think that there were any chance for a smaller scale project, 51% owned by the state, could potentially be more economic than the AKLNG project?
Well, first of all, I was not looking at the percentage of ownership. And all I was doing was asking what the cost difference of upsizing the pipe was. And as I said, I was interested in separating that question initially, and then it was brought back with a further motion to look at pump stations and to look at gas conditioning, and there was discussion about the engineering team that could do that and not letting them go, and a bunch of other discussion. But the simple motion that was before us, the written resolution, was just pipe size. And I thought that was pretty cheap. I thought that was the one thing that you could do that might get you into a better economic situation if the price were low enough. But we didn't have the answers to that, so that's an open question. But I haven't tried to figure out what's in everybody else's mind. I took it kind of as it came, and I explained that my vote was on pipe size, and that's why. Because I didn't want to spend a lot of money finding out things that we may not have to use.
No, I have a simpler question.
Yes.
And not that that one was complicated, but this is about as simple as they get. And you're an amazing man. You've done some amazing things in your life, but tell me two questions. Why are you the right guy for this job? And tell me that you recognize some of your limitations about potentially what you might have to learn before you become the right guy for this job.
Great questions. And I don't think there's any, quote, right person. I think different people learn different things, and you know, the thing that I see right now that's our biggest obstacle is the trust between the appropriators and the administrators. The legislature is, for all intents and purposes, the checkbook without the arms and legs of administration. The administration is the arms and legs without the checkbook. And it's intended that way. And I think if we're going to be successful, it's going to take from, I don't know where it comes, but my interest would be to be a part of rebuilding the trust between the two branches so that we can go forward. And trust is not a one item list. The trust is, you know, we all have friends that we love them, we trust them, we think highly of them, but we may not trust their judgment in this category or that category. We may not want to invest with them because we don't trust their investment advice or something else. But I think if we could get back to little pieces of trust building on top of each other, and all be on the same sheet of music, then I think we have a chance of getting a project. And we've had 40 years of failure, and that can go on if we're divided.
Follow up?
Well, that was a great answer to another question. but to the question at hand, just in your mind, why are you the right guy for the job? And what are some of the gaps that you would want to fill in if you're confirmed to be a better guy for the job?
Well, there's still lots of information that I don't have, I don't know. So the first thing is you need to do a lot of homework. And I've tried to meet, I mean, there's information that DNR has that is not really common to the executive branch. It's under confidentiality agreements. There's a whole question of confidentiality agreements. What do you want to get on the inside of? What do you need to find out? I think there are some good signs in terms of the kind of people working on this that we haven't seen before. I think there's some economic interest that may be lining up, and Point Thompson is one of them. But I think there's a lot of questions that come out of all that stuff. So I think the I don't know if I'm the best person. That's the short answer to that. That's up to you to decide, and it's not always the best person. It's the best person that you can get at the time that's available to do it or to help do it. But the thing that I need the most is always more education.
That's fair.
Further questions, committee members? Well, I want to go back to what you were just talking about with trust, Senator Halford. Senator Costello pointed out that Senate Bill 138 was extensively discussed last year. 51 committee hearings, countless testimony, consultants with expertise, who crafted a bill. As you know, we are a separate yet equal branch of government.
Mm-hmm.
We are concerned that the law that we passed after that extensive work continues to be followed. As Senator Costello pointed out, it's about a year before we will be to the feed decision. We will have some idea, first of all, whether this project is economic. If it's not, we'll know why it's not, so we can correct a smaller in-state, state-owned pipeline. So there's just a tremendous amount of information to be gained by waiting and just letting the law proceed. But we find ourselves in the place of having to pass a bill called House Bill 132, which basically underscores what we passed last year. And the governor is saying this is binding his hands, and yet you're saying that actually all you folks are interested in doing at AGDC, all you passed was a minor expanded backup. How are you reading this conflict? Are we binding the governor's hands by simply underscoring what we passed last session? Is that how you would feel had you been sitting in these seats last year?
Well, first of all, I have to admit that when I read the underlying legislation, I think I felt that it was the broadest grant of authority that I had seen in my entire career in this building to an executive branch. I think the desire to get something done passed a huge amount of authority onto the executive branch. And I would have had questions as that happened if I'd been in this process, and I would have had to get comfortable with that. The second part of it is I believe that the principal negotiators need to keep negotiating however long it takes to get people on the same side of the equation. And I don't like the fact that the bigger the project, the harder it is, the more we all have negative power. And unless we're together, we're not going to get anything. So I don't distrust the legislative branch, and I don't distrust the governor. I think the governor's intentions are right, and I think yours were right. And I think the conflict has got to be worked out between the players. And the corporation is really a small player because it is viewed as the corporation is the instrument of the executive branch to accomplish whatever these things are. But I think the negotiations need to occur with legislative branch and executive branch at the governor's level, and they need to continue until they get a solution.
Thank you. Senator Welikowski.
Thank you. I agree with Senator Muchiki that a smaller gas line is probably never more economical than a bigger line. The reason that we were constrained with AGDC to a smaller gas line was because we had a G in place, and that was the law of the land, that we couldn't build a 500 MCF gas line. And when we passed HB 138, we effectively resolved our differences with TransCanada. And the difference that we resolved was we can build a bigger gas line. That is, and I don't think anyone, I've been here through this whole debate, as have many people here, we never wanted a 500 MCF limit on our backup plan. We never wanted that. In fact, I remember the sponsors of 132 and probably many other people in this building complaining loudly about the fact that we were bound to that 500 MCF line. So when we passed HB 138 last year and said, we're resolved our differences with AGEA, with TransCanada, I see that as sort of freeing AGDC to go ahead and build a large diameter line, which is more economical. Everyone agrees it's more economical. Because why would we build a backup plan that's not economical? Why that makes no sense to pursue that. So I guess I'm missing something here, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, is the reason that you go to a bigger line to try to get a gas line that's more economical for the state in case for some reason HB 138 doesn't work out?
Well, I'm thinking of that story about the guys buying watermelons for a buck and selling them for a buck and arguing about why it wasn't working, and one of them said we should have bought a bigger truck. If you're losing per unit, you can't make it up in volume. But there is some place along that scale where you've got 90% of the economy of scale and you've got maybe a size that you could even look at. But the numbers of all of these projects are so far beyond our capacity that I'd have to be convinced that we had the capacity to build something that was economic, and I haven't got there yet. That doesn't mean I'm not listening, obviously.
Follow-up, Senator Welikowski? Further questions? Well, I'll introduce the concept of the confidentiality agreements. How do you feel about that? I don't know if you signed one or not. Perhaps you could clarify that and just give us your thoughts on participating in a confidentiality agreement.
I haven't signed one yet. I have signed them in the past. I signed one when I chaired the committee that went against the state's position on the BP-ARCO merger, which essentially got us ConocoPhillips. And that was, you know, anytime anyone in a public review position, and you're included, has to sign a confidentiality agreement, you end up with information that you can't explain to your constituents about what you did. And that's always hard and should always be taken seriously. But I think it was successful in the BP Oracle merger issue, and I think it's important to be able to know information that companies don't want to share with each other. There was a wealth of information in those days because we had both Oracle and BP's complete business plans. They're obviously not public, but there was a lot of fascinating information in there. But the bottom line is I would take the advice of the attorneys, and if a confidentiality agreement were necessary, I'd try to sign the minimum necessary for the information that I was trying to get. And I don't know, there's been argument about the past confidentiality agreement, and that may be a matter of opinion, but I have no problem with signing a confidentiality agreement necessary to gather information to be able to find out what you're trying to know and decide on.
I'm glad to hear that. Certainly, the AGDC board has significant fiduciary responsibility, and I think many of us, even here in the room, have served on boards of directors and understand that that is the primary responsibility of a board member. So understanding the information, having that information, is critical to your role and responsibility. So I appreciate your answer. Do you know who Sterling Gallagher is? And if you do, could you tell us what role he has in this pipeline, what interactions you may have had with him?
That's my coat ring.
Oh, please. I'll let you go answer your coat.
No, it's mine.
It will stop eventually?
Whether I'm picking up the kids or something like
that. Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I guess it will get picked up today.
Or it's the one that wants to get picked up. It'll stop, but he'll start again. I think I will turn it off.
Oh, sorry. Please, take your time.
Since we're on the record, Madam Chair, just a
yes,
comment.
Yes, Senator Michiki.
I think we should evaluate folks that are up for confirmation by the ringtones that they actually purposely chose.
I thought that was the default ringtone. I
think it should be who's on the other end.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Excuse me.
Sure.
Now, would you go back to where I was supposed to be that I was totally derailed from?
Wondering if you know a gentleman named Sterling Gallagher, what role he has played, if he's had interaction with you.
I don't know what role he's played in this. He was Hammond's Revenue Commissioner, I believe. I've known him forever back to that time. And I know that he was around in transition and trying to help. I don't know what his role could have been in any of this stuff. I've seen him. I've said hi to him. I don't think I've had a substantive discussion with him about anything.
Very good. Thank you. Further questions, committee members?
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I should clarify something because it sounds like it might have been misunderstood. The economy of scale on pipelines is not what I was talking about earlier. It was the economy of scale of the entire project. Okay, so if a integrated model from wellhead to import terminal is not economic, a relatively piecemeal project where the state owns the pipeline and then others presumably come in and save the day with the other models of liquefaction and gas treatment and that sort of thing where you have three different projects. That's the part that doesn't take advantage of the economy of scale. So I just wanted to make sure that you understood that, and I think you probably did. Pipeline economics are simply pounds of steel per linear foot. Higher pressures require more compression. That's the easy stuff, mm-hmm. right? The pipeline's the easy stuff. The beauty of AKLNG is the integrated model with four partners equally invested. And so that's the part that I worry about is because I governor. I like the governor. I know the governor is in this business because his heart is in it for the people of Alaska. That's never something I've ever doubted. What worries me is the lack of experience on sort of real global players versus some of these other folks that have expressed an interest that are not currently and may never be in the other part of the business that would make this an integrated project. Can you share some of your concerns with that? If you put a big sign out that says gas for sale, is anyone interested? Everyone will say yes. If you put a sign out that says gas for sale, $7 per MBTU, the list shrinks, okay? So far we've waved a sign around that says gas for sale and the whole world is interested. So can you help me understand my concern with the diversion with the ASAP project is there seems to be a lack of value for that integrated aligned model. And I'd like to just hear how you feel about those two different projects, one being a pipeline and the other being a sort of equal partner integrated system.
Well, I guess the pipeline is the cheapest of the three. The gas conditioning plant and the liquefaction plant are the biggest numbers, and the line itself is the cheapest piece. And the question of steel strength is pretty easily calculated compared to the others. I think, you know, every component combined has got to be economic to every participant. And if they're not, it's not going to come together. So I'm not sure that I think, you know, as you just sit and think about something, it's easy to separate the pipeline and to wish you could build a pipeline and get somebody else to do everything else. The ability to be able to do that and get something that works, I think, is very, very limited. I mean, part of my education in this is to learn a lot of things that may make your preconceived notions not work. And whenever you don't have the responsibility to actually decide something, you have all kinds of opinions. I mean, you know, we're in a profession where we decide without information on a lot of stuff. And we do our best and we go on. Once you actually have the ability to influence something, then you've got the responsibility to know what the choices really are. And I'm not satisfied that I know all the choices. But asking the question on pipe strength didn't seem like a problem to me. But there's a lot of other things that are involved in making something. You can't turn a $10 billion project into a $60 billion project without an awful lot of difference.
Follow-up? Further questions from committee members? All right. Seeing none. Senator Helfrich, I want to acknowledge and express sincere respect for the decades of experience you have in this body, the knowledge you gained here, the expertise. One of the comments Senator Machicki talked about was qualifications, and you made the comment that you didn't necessarily have the expertise in this, those are not exactly your words. I'm paraphrasing. But just for the record, there were three people in these three seats that had more than 100 years of actual hands-on experience building pipelines, planning large projects like this around the world. And the difficulty we have is knowing that had that resolution come forward to that group, they would have said, wait a minute, just increasing the strength of a pipeline means X, Y, Z as well. And so you see the concern that we have. and why we ask such perhaps difficult questions of you. I appreciate you being here. Any closing remarks before we sign the document to put your name forward?
I appreciate your role in the process, and it is going to take agreement, and that's the bottom line. Together, maybe we can get a gas line. Divided, I don't think there's a chance.
I think there's a famous saying, united we stand, divided we fall. Someone said that. Thank you. So with that, in accordance with AS 3905080, the Resources Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Alaska Gasline Development Corporation Board of Directors, Richard Halford. This does not reflect an attempt by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during any further sessions. So I'll pass the document around for signature. We'll take a brief at ease. Senate Resources will come back to order. Next item up is House Bill 70. I understand we have a proposed working document. Vice Chair Costello.
You caught me a little off guard.
Pardon me. We'll take a moment while you find the document.
Madam Chair, I move Senate CS for CS for House Bill Number 70, version 29-LS0372/Piper. Before the committee is a working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. So I am welcoming here Representative Brewer and his able assistant. So welcome. We do have this working document in front of us, and just for your information, David James from the Department of Fish and Game is on the line, as is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of DNR. I understand that Deputy Commissioner Fogles is going to explain the changes to the bill?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Some slight changes between this and the original version that's been around the building a little bit. So.
Excellent. If you would identify yourself for the record, the Secretary is recording this.
Thank you. My name is Representative Adam Wolf from District 5 in Fairbanks.
Very good. So I'll have Deputy Commissioner explain the changes.
Sure.
All right. Deputy Commissioner Fogles, welcome.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Ed Fogles, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Can you hear me okay?
Very nicely, loud and clear.
Great, thank you. Also with me is Gerald Jennings. He's our Chief Surveyor for DNR. And so what you have before you in version P, after I found out that you wanted me to vouch for the accuracy of the legals for this one more time, personally, I decided to have our survey staff do one more top-to-bottom scrub, and there were three things that sort of came out of that. And the first change is on page 2, line 1, where the word instruction was deleted and replaced with the word instrument. And that was primarily due to the fact that the original documents for this track were very hard to read, and our survey staff just took a very close look and realized that they had been misread in the original bill. The second change on page 3, line 2, for the same reason, the year 1976 was deleted and replaced with the year 1978, and again, that was because the original documents were very hard to read. The third change, on page 3, lines 13 through 14, the words, and the portions of, and they were removed. And then the section 6 now begins with the words, the portions of. And actually, I believe there was a little misprint in there where an extra the was put in there, and I think that can be probably taken out at some point as a typo, but so it should read the portions of east one half south on and on and on. And the actual reason for that change, I'm going to have Gerald Jennings explain to you, if that's all right, Madam Chair.
That would be great. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Okay. Good, Gerald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Gerald Jennings. And the change on lines 13 and 14 are related to the protecting the state's right-of-way for Farmers Loop Road in the event that survey in the future reveals that a couple of the output parts actually encroach slightly into the right-of-way. as it was originally listed in the description, two of those four output parts were lying south of the right-of-way, and two did not address the right-of-way. So we this version now addresses all four output parts lying, only the portions lying south of the Farmers Loop Road right-of-way.
So, Madam Chair, that's our explanation for the changes, and we are ready to answer any other questions that you might have of us.
Thank you. With that explanation, I'll remove my objection as a further objection to the new working document. Seeing none, the document then is adopted and before the committee. So any questions for Deputy Commissioner Vogels about the change or anything? Any questions from the bill sponsor, Representative Wohl, or his staff? Senator Stoltz?
Well, I think I have a real critical question. There's an animal classic under our gaming statutes. And is this going to change the odds and probabilities that all of you researched that?
Just kidding. You're referring to the cranes, I think. Through the chair, I would say the answer is no.
And through the chair, Senator Stoltz.
Identify yourself for the
record. For the record, I'm David Dunsmore, Chief of Staff to Representative Adam Wohl. The more underlying thing, this won't change any current land uses in these parcels because they're already managed consistent with the management plan. So the Crane Classic or any other current land uses would not be affected by this bill.
Very good. Further questions for the sponsor or his staff? Or Deputy Commissioner. Yes, Senator Machicki.
Just any of the parties, starting with the representative, are we aware of anyone that has a problem with this bill or is worried about land going into permanent conservation in that area or anything like that?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, no. We've had a few hearings on this already and opened it up to public comment, and the only ones we have are supportive.
Excellent. Thank you.
Senator Machicki also asked me earlier why we were passing this again, as we recall passing it last year. And I appreciate Deputy Commissioner Fogel's double-checking, triple-checking, quadruple-checking the property descriptions, because that was the problem with last year's bill. We had some errors in the property description, so the bill had to be vetoed, in case other committee members are wondering why this sounds so familiar. Any other questions? I'll just say I appreciate you doing this. I love looking at this map. I have walked so many of these trails, as this was, this Kramer's Field was a dairy where my family and I got milk from as a child. And so fond memories of the area, and it's beautiful. I love it when the cranes come through. So thank you, Representative, for sponsoring the bill. If there are no other questions, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, is there anyone online wishing to testify? I'll close public testimony. If there's no further discussion, I will ask Vice Chair Costello for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate CS for CS for House Bill Number 70 as amended with attached general fiscal note from committee with individual committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill will pass from this committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the documents. We'll come back on the record. So the next bill up is Senate Bill 48. It deals with non-resident hunting or sport fishing licenses. I welcome the sponsor, first of all, is Senator Stedman. I welcome to the testimony table his staff, Randy Raro. So welcome, Randy.
Members of the Senate Resources Committee, for the record, my name is Randy Ruaro, R-U-A-R-O, staff to Senator Stedman. SB 48 encourages former Alaskans who are no longer residents to return to Alaska to hunt or fish with family members. The incentive in the bill is that the qualifying former Alaskan would be allowed to pay the reduced resident rate for their hunting or fishing license. To qualify for the break on license fees, the former Alaskan must be a U.S. citizen, have been an Alaska resident in the past, held a resident license for that activity, paid the fee for the resident license, and be sponsored by an Alaska resident family member whom they will hunt or fish with when they return. There is a cap in the bill on the number of these licenses that could be issued at 1,000. In speaking with the fish and game officials from Montana, which has a similar program, they said it took a while to build up in popularity, so we're not anticipating that it would reach that cap in the first year. That's it in a nutshell, ma'am.
Very good. Committee members, any questions, comments? Senator Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Weil, does this make any other substantive changes on requirements for non-residents, i.e., obtaining a guide for doll sheep hunts and brown bear and others?
Through the Chair, Senator Stoltz, there is a provision in the bill that exempts these non-residents from having be required to hunt or fish, hunt with a registered guide.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Senator Stoltz? No. Senator Wanikowski.
Thank you. How would this impact dip netters? Would this allow non-residents to go out and dip net?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think the difference would be to the acquiring a license at a reduced rate. I don't think the bill makes a distinction by type of fishing activity. So if there's a reduced resident rate for that fishing license, then that's what they would acquire regardless of whether they were dip netting or sport fishing.
So
follow-up?
Just so I'm clear, so they would not gain certain other rights that only residents have, like dip netting or accessing personal use fisheries?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, if a right exists for a resident and they qualify under this bill for that resident license, then they would have that right their resident has now. So it could, expand that universe.
Okay. Yes, follow up.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd support that. In fact, I wouldn't support that. Other question is on king stamps. So you go out and you get a resident fishing license, and then would this apply to lower-cost king stamps as well?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, it would apply to, as written, as I read it, to the license. I haven't seen language in the bill that would apply to the king stamp. I'm not actually familiar with the differences in the, if there's a difference for non-resident residents on king stamps.
Follow-up. Though that is an interesting question, Senator Wanikowski, and we should get an answer to that. The other question you posed before it, we need an answer to also. I don't believe there's a fee for PU.
There's not.
It's automatically goes with your fishing license, so obviously it would give them access as well. But follow-up question.
Yeah. My other question is on a little different line, and that's on page 2, lines 2 and 3, where it says, may not hunt or fish unless personally accompanied by the non-resident sponsor. So how do you define personally accompanied? Is it a lot of times I go fish with people and somebody will stay in one part of the river and maybe the other person will go up a few hundred yards up the other side of the river? Is there like personally accompanied? Is there a space requiem that you envision or that maybe the law has looked at and has given a little guidance on that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's not a defined term. The intent is that the family member that's the sponsor would be on the same trip in the vicinity with the family member that's qualified for the reduced fee license, but we don't have a definition for physical presence proximity.
And I think just one more, and, mm-hmm. and then page 2, line 4, it says it is exempt from AS 1605-407A1. Can you just tell us what that is?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that goes to Senator Stoltz's previous question about non-residents being required to be in the, guided by a professional guide.
Thank you.
Yes, very good. Any further questions? Senator Michiki?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little bit worried about there not being a minimum time in state. So you could literally come up here for a temporary project for a year, become a resident, and then move outside and just happen to have a relative by blood or marriage and forever have a non-resident, have not, or have resident access to our hunting and fishing resources at the cost of a resident. Did the sponsor consider a minimum that sort of made them relatively Alaskan, a 5-year or something like that?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, we have looked at various options like that, and I would agree that the time frame to be determined to be a resident is can be fairly short. I think it's the intent to remain in Alaska for an indefinite period is what I've seen in several statutes. So that's an area that we'll continue to look at to define.
Okay.
Follow up?
Well, and it, you know, once in a while it happens. I'm in full agreement with Senator Wilikowski on the personal use option that clearly is for the survival of Alaskans, not necessary to load on an airplane to take somewhere else. Right? That's something I'd like to see discussed in detail and possibly amended if the sponsor sees fit.
Very good. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What was the justification or what was the thought process where you determined they had to previously hold a license?
Well, through the chair, Senator Stoltz, we were trying to create some ties to actual participation in a fishery or activity, hunting activity, along with being a former resident. So we were trying to build, you know, up a level of ties to the activity and the state both at the same time. But it's not a perfect, I guess, mix, as Senator Michiki pointed out. There's different ways to set the requirements, and we're open to taking suggestions and working on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's one of those conundrums. You don't want to necessarily try to fix something that you don't want to vote for, but too much where you might become semi-palatable, but I could think of a dynamic. I remember not having to buy my license until I was 16 and having my year 0 to 15. I wasn't too active from 0 to a certain age, but had I had the misfortune of being yanked out of here and I came back, I wouldn't qualify if I had left before I was 16. That's the way I'm reading this. Is that a
Actually, through the chair, Senator Stoltz, and I have to do a little more research myself, but I can't recall right offhand at what age you are required to get a license. Is it
16?
Maybe 16. Yeah. In which case, you're correct. Under the bill as written, you wouldn't qualify.
Follow up, Senator Stoltz.
There's other folks with questions. I'll wait.
Senator Costello.
Oh, thank you. I was just thinking, I hope that if this passes, I'm not in Fred Meyer when the 1,001st guy is trying to buy the license, because I can imagine that there would be some displeasure. And my question then is, can this be fair when you're creating two classes of people, the first 1,000 and the second 1,000, or just we have a history of in our state of sort of, you know, those kinds of issues, and I was just curious if you thought about that.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, it does create, I guess, a sort of a first-in-the-door dynamic, but we felt it was important to cap the licenses in case they did turn out to be overly popular and drawing in large numbers of folks who would be coming here anyway. So we were trying to put an upper limit on that number. But it does create that dynamic, which I think isn't very uncommon in Alaska sport fishing and hunting. You know, there's lottery hunts and other things. So the dynamic, I think, is generally present, but it is also present in this bill.
Follow up.
And I assume that that's because the loss of revenue to the state, you wouldn't want that to get too big a number. Right now, it's about $500,000.
Through the chair, Senator Costello, it was a revenue issue, and at the same time, we wanted to have the program in place for a few years to see how it, if it was truly popular. It took several years in the Montana program to build up significant following.
And could you just go through the difference in the license fees, just for the public that's listening? I mean, it's in the fiscal note right here. I can read it, but I just thought it'd be interesting to know, to hear it.
Well, there was a new fiscal, through the chair, Senator Costello, there was a new fiscal note that just came in right before the hearing, and I hadn't had a chance to digest it, to be honest with you. I think it was revised downward significantly to reflect the fact that the program wasn't expected to max out in the first year. The previous note assumed 1,000 people, none of whom would have otherwise come to Alaska, and so the agency went back and looked at that and decided that a more perhaps realistic assumption is it wouldn't max out the first year, and not everyone taking advantage of the program would have been a traveler to Alaska anyway.
Madam Chair, I was actually interested in just an explanation of what does a non-resident pay right now for a fishing license and hunting, and what would it move to if this bill were to pass?
Through the Chair, Senator Costello, I'd have to get back to you with all the details, because I think there's different tag fees, and depending whether it's doll sheep or brown bear, but I can get that list.
Mm-hmm. One final question.
Yes, follow up.
What does the department use the proceeds from the fishing hunting licenses for? Like, what do they use it within the department? Is it research? Is it?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I'm not 100% sure if the funds could be traced out, I guess, to exactly what function of use there would be in the department. I'm not sure that you can separate it that way.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Senator Walkowski, you had a question also.
So on hunting license, there's, you mentioned there's lotteries oftentimes for game. And does this have the potential to crowd Alaskans out of the lotteries?
Through the chair, Senator Walkowski, we hadn't really thought about the lottery hunts in drafting the bill. As written, a non-resident could apply for and receive a resident license if they met these requirements, and we hadn't taken it the additional step to sort out whether that would also give them standing to apply for the lottery hunts. That's a piece that we'll have to take a look at.
Follow up, Senator Walkowski. Do you know, Mr. Raro, how many vendors sell these licenses in Alaska? Fishing licenses in general?
Through the chair, I'm pretty sure it numbers in the thousands. Last time I looked at it, it was a lot of sporting goods stores, supermarkets, even small vendors, so bait stores. Last time I looked at it, I think it was in the thousands.
Didn't I just read that you can do this online now, get your fishing licenses online?
Through the chair, to the chair, that's correct. My understanding is you can obtain your license now online.
So conceivably, these could be gone within an hour, right?
Through the chair, I believe in for this particular license, it's an exception to the ability to get a license online. It's actually going to require a paper affidavit sworn out that you meet the requirements of the bill.
Okay, so that kind of helps. Do you know how many fishing licenses are issued each year? Do you have any idea how many?
Through the chair, again, it's been several years since I was looking at those numbers, but I believe it's in the hundreds of, I want to say several hundreds of thousands of licenses a year.
Okay, so again, the concern that's already been expressed that reaching 1,000 actually might happen rather quickly could be an issue.
Through the chair, that's true.
All right, great. Any other questions? Senator Stoltz.
And Madam Chair, thank you, Mr. Rowe. One of probably one of the more contentious issues of the Board of Game Cyclists last night was doll sheep hunts. And some of my constituents who sell doll sheep hunts certainly have a position. Some of my constituents will feel they're frozen out by sometimes out-of-state hunters, but then they say, well, those folks are paying a lot. Have you thought about if we're going to give a Californian or a New Jersey cousin have you thought about the mess and that argument alone, just on the doll sheep, that was the focal issue of the last 40-game cycle. And I just can't imagine trying to tell all my constituents why I let somebody's cousin jump potentially ahead of them as well. That might be the second degree of kindred, maybe a brother, I'm not sure.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, that is certainly an important issue that we'll take a look at. We hadn't chased down the every potential hunt that could a non-resident could be allowed into. So there may be several or some that are of such importance to industry and to Alaskans that the bill may not apply to that particular hunt. The thought behind the bill was more general sport fish for king salmon, deer hunting, areas of hunting and fishing where there's not a allocation crowd issue.
So, you were thinking about those 70,000 Alaskans that live down here.
Chair, no, hadn't really limited it geographically, but
that is rhetorical. That's okay.
But I think it does bear some looking into to these particular hunts that are lottery hunts or very limited access. So maybe worthy of a carve out or an exception.
Further questions for Mr. Rao?
Just one observation, Madam Chair. This is make personal use look real simple in comparison. So, thank you.
I don't see anyone signed up online to testify on the bill. We'll open public testimony. There's no one online. Is there anyone here in the room that wishes to testify? I don't see anyone, but I'm going to keep public testimony open. We'll set the bill aside as we certainly pose some questions for the staff of the bill sponsor. Mr. Rowe, thank you very much for being here today to present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So this will conclude our meeting for today. That ends our agenda. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, April 8th. We'll take up two confirmations for Board of Fisheries. We have Robert Ruffner and Orville Huntington. So at this time, I'll adjourn the meeting. The time is 4:55 p.m. Thank you.